Has anybody got any wins they want to share? Anybody hit new targets, weight loss?
Oh. I'm just looking through who's on the call right now, Greg, trying to see if there's anybody I can highlight. Well, both Nate and Jimmy are on the call, and they're always kicking some serious butt. So I guess one win from Nate is that he's alive. And Nate was he wanted a new plan. He wanted something very metabolically demanding. And I'm like, "Are you sure?" And he's like, "Yeah, yes."
He asked for
Yeah, and then lo
that.
day after, he's like, "This is a horrible idea." So yeah, it's definitely a win. I'm glad to see him here.
So, guys, a couple of things. There's still a few spaces left for Costa Rica if anybody's still interested. I believe we start on the 8th. You're coming, Steve, right?
I am, sir. Are you going for the whole thing as well for the extended
Yeah.
trip? Yeah.
Yeah, should be fun.
I'd love to go, man. I think I'd get castrated if I did though.
Off of the whole thing? Yeah.
Yeah, leaving the wife with like three kids alone in New Brunswick without anybody else to help. Yeah, I'd come back and things would be on fire.
My wife likes when I go away. Don't know what that says about it, but. And also, I don't think he is. He's normally on the calls. But just a sh you don't, I don't think he's here, but just a shout out to our client of the month. I believe it's Russ Reynolds this month, Steve's client. No, not Steve, sorry, Chris's client. He's normally on these calls, but he doesn't seem to be here yet. So we'll give it one more minute for the extra stragglers to come along and then we'll start. Nice to see Mohammed's here. Mohammed, how are you, sir? And Samira?
Greg, he's just hopping on right now.
Is that the girl's phone?
Yes.
Yeah, that's Russell. Good to see you.
Russell, congratulations. We saw your photos yesterday. Look absolutely amazing. Client of the month. Great work.
Thank you, my friend.
You looks amazing. Well deserved. And sorry, someone just had a quick question. Go ahead, Chris.
So, what are the exact dates that the, sorry, life's kind of crazy over here, but could you remind me what the exact dates are of the retreat and which specific nights are covered in the with the hotel package?
So I believe for the training camp, it is the evening of the 8th, 9th, and 10th that will be covered as part of the package. So I believe that's the Friday, Saturday, and Sunday night. I know Sarah's still on the call. She might be able to confirm that, but I'm almost 100% sure that's the case.
Josie is our retreat guru. Chris, what I'll do is I will have Josie reach out to you if you're okay with that. And I will have her follow up with any questions you might have.
Yeah, that's great. I shot her a note on Telegram, but that'd be great. Thanks, Sarah.
Okay, guys. Oops, there's Michael. So, as the second Wednesday of every single month is, it's always in regards to nutrition and the way we can manipulate nutrition in order to get the results that we want. So just a quick show of hands, who's actually dieting at the moment? Steve? Yeah. Okay, so we got a few. Little bit. Keith, Dave, you are. That's great. So some of you, Mohammed, some of you guys might be on a bulk, but there will be stages where you'll be coming into cuts, and we're going to look for ways that you can manipulate, whether that's macros, whether that's supplements, in order to stave off or control your appetite in that process. It's one of the biggest, the physiological side of things is one of the biggest factors of why people tend to fail when it comes to diet plans. So today I'm going to take you through the science of appetite, and then the things that you guys can do in order to get the most benefit out of a plan. So let me just get this up for you guys. And then we'll get started. Okay. So I did not come up with this very, very fancy title. This is thanks to Phoebe. But today I want to take you through the signs of appetite. So how to understand your body signals, curb your cravings, and change your behavior to make healthier choices. Ben asked me to do this a few weeks ago. So he asked me to go into the most recent research on appetite and why we get hungry and the things we can do to prevent it. And I spent a couple of weeks doing it and I sent it to him and I was sat kind of waiting for his approval. And he was like, "Yeah, dude, that's great, but what about the psychology, man?" And I was like, "Right, let's separate that to start with. I'm not going to go through the psychology of it today. It's too very, very different approaches, and it would cause an awful lot of a mess trying to present them both. So today we're only going to look at the physiological response. Now, psychology obviously leads into it, and it's hard to separate head from body, right? But today we're just going to talk about like what are some of the major physiological markers and things that actually contribute to how hungry we feel, and then some of the actual applications that we can use in order to make sure that you don't feel them as much as possible. For some of you guys getting down to super, super lean levels, there will always be an element of hunger. There'll always be an element of hunger with any diet. But the idea for us as coaches to give to you is to make sure that there's no stone left unturned in order to try and figure out what we can do to help you. Now, what are we going to try and figure out in this presentation is we're going to look at the big picture. So I'll speak about the hormones briefly and the signals or incretins that actually affect your appetite. We talk about how they'll interact briefly, and then we'll touch on the lifestyle factors that you can include. We'll talk about what the best diet is, and we'll talk about what supplements can be used. When I say what the best diet is normally, I'm normally being facetious. I'm normally like, there's a million diets you can use for any sort of application to any specific goal. So people will talk about like, what's best for fat loss? Is it carnivore, low carb, high carb, vegan, vegetarian, whatever it is? And there'll always be a little bit of, it depends. Now, with this, it seems to be a little bit more clear of what the best macronutrient distribution at least is for getting the best results in terms of staving off appetite. And I would normally speak similarly when it comes to supplements. I'd be like, dude, unless you have all the rest of this stuff right, forget about supplements. But with this particular problem, supplements can be really effective to help you if you're trying to lose body fat and trying to keep appetite at bay. Now, we'll get through this as quick. We'll get through this part of it as quickly as we can. But understanding when we look at appetite and how our body reacts, it is all based centrally around a part of the brain called the hypothalamus. This regulates our body fat stores, it regulates our temperature, it regulates our energy expenditure, and it regulates how hungry or how full we feel. But there is an axis. As you guys know, nothing in the body tends to work in isolation. I think Western medicine, they've done really well at compartmentalizing everything and taking it as a this problem or a that problem. But particularly with this, there's many different organs involved. And I could have put more in here, but just to, for ease, I pick the most important ones, but also the ones that you can manipulate the most. So the organs that tend to be involved are the pancreas, and that's going to be in regards to insulin. We hear about insulin a lot. It's almost a boogeyman, right, in terms of fat loss, but it's not, but it can be when it's chronically high. But we'll touch on that later. We've got the adrenals. Most of you guys will know the adrenals as releasing the stress hormone cortisol. Again, Acute levels is an amazing thing. It helps us to train. It helps with clarity and memory. It helps with learning. It helps with all these really cool things. But when left chronically high, it can cause a lot of issues for appetite. One of the more surprising ones that you guys mightn't realize, or maybe you do, so stop me if that's the case, but when we look at fat tissue or adipose tissue, it was always looked at for such a long period of time as just this empty vat that just stored excess calories to be used later. Science knows now really well that the vast majority or all fat tissue is extremely active endocrinely. So, like, it releases a lot of hormones and signaling to the rest of the body. So, adipose plays a, or fat tissue plays a massive role in how we feel or perceive hunger. And then you can look at the gut. So, the gut is where we get a lot of the hormones that are responsive, particularly to the types of foods that we eat. So, that's one part of this equation that we can really influence. And I'll talk about those hormones down the line. So, we'll break them down individually. But leptin is the hormone that comes from fat. Leptin is like this long-term barometer telling our body or telling the brain or the hypothalamus, like I mentioned, it's feeding back to the hypothalamus from the fat cells, saying we have enough energy stores or we don't. So when we eat food and fat gets stored within fat cells, it'll release this hormone called leptin, which will feed back to the brain to say, you've had enough food, it is time to stop, right? And when they found this is a relatively new hormone. It was found in 1994. And when they found this, what do you think Western medicine did with this? Started injecting a bunch of people with it to try and figure out if this was the cure. It worked really well in mice. It made fat mice really skinny, really, really quickly. But the problem is, they realized that when they injected it in humans, only in a very select part of the population did it work. It's those who had this genetic factor associated with not being able to produce leptin. And that's where they realized that there was another mechanism at play here. So it's this idea that the brain and everything, because they started to test overweight people to see if they had low or high leptin. They assumed they would have low, and that's why they continued to eat. But these overweight people all had high leptin. So it indicates that actually there was a problem at the brain. So the brain had stopped listening to the signal of leptin. Like a lot of us will remember what like insulin resistance is, right? But actually, it turns out that people who cannot control their appetite have this thing called leptin resistance. The brain has stopped listening to the signal. And it just doesn't matter how much leptin gets pumped out, it doesn't tell the brain to calm down. We don't need any more food. We've got enough stores here. A lot of the time, we always, and it, when you, let's go to the extreme case of it, when you have people with like type 2 diabetes and the advice out there is you need to lose weight. It's like eat less, move more. Like eat less, move more is information that's apt, it's completely on point, but those people cannot control appetite. So just giving that basic information is not applicable for a lot of them because they have voracious appetites that they find really hard to stem. Okay, and leptin is one of the molecules at play there. Now we all know about insulin, right? It was in the 90s and 2000s, insulin was the storage hormone for fat. It's the reason why we got fat because we had high insulin levels. And that's not necessarily the case, but insulin acutely, so when we eat healthy and we use carbohydrates or we eat carbohydrates, we get these spikes in insulin that control the blood sugar within our system. The body wants to keep blood sugar within these ranges. If it gets too low, obviously it's a danger to life. If it gets too high, it causes all this damage in the vascular system. And when this happens, but when and when it happens acutely, that's no problem. We release insulin, it deals with it. We have more carbohydrates, insulin deals with that blood sugar. When it becomes chronically high, we lose its signal as well. So when it comes acutely, It helps to lower appetite. When it happens chronically, and I'll touch on it in a little bit, it actually, the brain loses that same signal. So we get insulin resistance. So think about it, leptin resistance and insulin resistance within the brain. Don't worry about all these nomenclatures, all right? Like there's a lot to take in here, but just remember, ghrelin is the one hormone, one of the major hormone in regards to the feeling of hunger. So it gets released in the small intestine when blood sugar drops, or it gets released in the stomach when there's an unavailability of energy. And that is the major hunger signaling hormone, is ghrelin. Now, you don't have to remember what these are. So, like you got peptide YY, GLP-1, glucagon-like peptide 1, and cholecystokinin. These are incretins within the gut that tell us we're full. And these are the ones that we can manipulate through diet extremely, extremely well. Okay, so just keep it in mind. So when we start to touch on methods that we're going to use to stave off hunger, these are no we're normally either unraveling the mess, the metabolic mess that I'm going to explain in 1 second, or we're trying to affect these to make us feel fuller with the types of food, types of supplements, type of lifestyle that we lead. Now, we all know, or we've all heard about cortisol. Cortisol, similar to leptin, similar to insulin, in acute levels is extremely beneficial. There's a reason why we release cortisol after we train. It's in a response to stress. It allows us to learn and adapt from that stress. It breaks down muscle tissue, which it should do after we train, allowing it to be remodeled so that we can grow back stronger. But chronically elevated, as we'll touch on in a sec, can lead to overeating and can compound leptin and insulin resistance. So that's where all these hormones all play in. But like I said, these don't happen in a vacuum. We don't just see dysregulation of one of these things. We see dysregulation of all of it, right? And there's one other one, right? I'm going to give a brief anecdote. I was doing this a few weeks ago when I got asked to write about it. And my wife comes into the room and she asks me, she's like, "Oh, what are you writing on now?" And I was like, "Oh, the science of appetite." So she kind of, you can see her, she kind of glazes over. She pretends like she's interested. She listens to me for a few minutes, humors me, and then she kind of just trots off and pretends like she cares, which is nice of her. At least she pretends. But she came back to me 2 days ago and go, "Oh, you're doing stuff on appetite, right?" I was like, "Yeah." She goes, "Huberman did a podcast on that." And I was like, "So wait a minute, you listened to 90 minutes of Andrew Huberman, but you wouldn't listen to me for 3 minutes." Now, maybe it's because he's handsome and charming, but he goes into this hormone an awful lot more than I am here. Right? So it's called melanocyte stimulating hormone. Don't worry about like the name and stuff, but it's fascinating in the sense, if you think of what melano means, think about that melanin. So it's in response to light. So there's a reason why during the summer we tend to eat less. There's a reason why in the summer we tend to have higher libidos. It's because of this hormone. So a lot of the time, like I know for Brits, right, we don't get exposure to sunshine that much. We get a few weeks in the summer where it tends to be really nice. But the Brits will always say when they go abroad, so when we go onto the continent and we all go to Spain, we don't want to eat as much. Our appetite isn't as high. And that's because of this hormone. And it's only made in response to the sun and only in a certain way, which I'll touch on when we get to some of the stuff that we can do in order to affect all these hormones. Now, I was thinking about this. I should have put this in a bit of a cycle, like, so it should have been like leptin, insulin, and cortisol in a cycle and how they all feed into each other. But where this becomes like the metabolic milieu of all these things, or the mess that tends to occur, is based around these three hormones. So insulin, when we become resistant, actually blocks the receptors in the brain for receiving leptin. Leptin then goes down and causes more insulin resistance in the periphery away from the brain, and cortisol compounds all of that. So when we have high leptin, high insulin, high cortisol, it's just metabolic mess, and you cannot control your appetite in those circumstances. It's when you hear these people that are just stuck on the blood sugar roller coaster all day, and the only thing that keeps people with either energy or any sort of feeling of satiation is if they're constantly eating. So these people that snack all the time can't make it from one meal to the next. Like if they miss a meal, they fall apart. Highly driven stress-wise towards food. Like we have to remember with cortisol in particular, when cortisol is really high, that signal can skip the prefrontal cortex. So it can skip the part of the brain where we make an executive decision and can go straight to the limbic part of the brain and make us think instinctively or primitively, if you want to put it that way. So we seek out immediate gratification when we have high cortisol for long periods of time. So whether that's with where we make bad decisions, right? So whether that's based around like, what are those like hedonic things that we do? So like gambling, sex, alcohol, food, all those things that we probably shouldn't be doing in those circumstances that we tend to pursue when we have high cortisol. But all these interactions make that big mess of why you can't control your appetite when you get into these positions. So that's the science bit of it done. But what does the science say about ways we can unravel that mess? And especially when we look at, like, we spoke about ghrelin. Remember, we said ghrelin being the most important of the hormones that make us feel full. That is very much based around circadian rhythms. So it will go up and come down based off the times of the day that we eat. So if you have constantly broken or disrupted eating patterns, ghrelin will elevate sporadically and when it's not controllable. So people who eat at consistent times every day will get a ghrelin spike just before those times. So it's you can anticipate it and you can be prepared for it because you'll be able to eat directly after that. Now, that in saying, it's important to remember that it can be manipulated. So someone will obviously, people tend to ask them, what about people who intermittent fast? Do they not get ghrelin hits? Now, normally you can shift ghrelin over time if you want to. So if you eat at breakfast, lunch, and dinner every single day, you will get hungry about 45 minutes before each of those meals, pretty consistently. But recognize that you can shift that by like an hour at a time if you want to change those meal times or to inevitably skip a meal. But it seems to be noted that those who front load food tend to control ghrelin throughout the day. So people who eat the majority of their calories earlier in the day and titrate and allow it to come down as the day goes on tend to be able to control appetite better. But in the West now, we tend to do it the opposite way. Which normally leads to dysregulated eating and dysregulated circadian rhythms in this way. We all tend to eat very little in the morning, a little bit more for lunch, and extremely high amounts in the evening. That doesn't tend to work with our circadian rhythm. This circadian rhythm being this internal clock within our brain that tells the body when we should be doing things based off sunlight and the 24-hour clock, right? So having really consistent meal timings is really important to control appetite. And this was one of the most fascinating ones that I found when I was going through it. So I touched on that like melanocyte stimulating hormone or releasing hormone. That only gets released when we receive ultraviolet light through the eyes. So sun exposure, and I know it's one of the top five that loads of our like coaches put out. It's like sun exposure first thing in the morning. It regulates circadian rhythms as well, but also it's shown that it really affects our appetite. Melanocyte stimulating hormone. There's actually a peptide now that's being used, which is of similar amino acid strain. It obviously gives us what people are using to get a tan. So you can use it to increase your tan, but it also is a massive appetite suppressant and a massive libido buster, booster, not buster. So this, like people might say, that they tend to have a higher libido in the summer as well, and it's because of this. So getting light exposure, and you can use this through UV lights in your home as well. It doesn't have to be from the sun. It's ultraviolet light exposure through the irises, not with sunglasses. That does not work in the same way. Okay. So getting light exposure regulates your appetite extremely well. Now, what diet? I know I said what diet is the best. Right. And I know that if there's some stuff in here where you're going to say, duh, look, we do this already. Like you're going to be, so like diets based mostly around protein, high fiber foods, and fatty acid therapy, which I'll touch on, have the biggest effect on GLP-1, peptide YY, and decrease insulin resistance and leptin resistance. So all the things that make us feel full and all the things that mess or that unravel that metabolic mess I was talking about. Also, those who actually mindfully eat less calories and feel fuller. Whether that's got anything to do with the fact that actually allowing these hormones to actually work, or is it something to do with lowered cortisol? I couldn't really find that in the research exactly what the mechanism was. But diets based mostly around protein, fiber is a huge one, right? It just pops up over and over again in terms of regulating appetite. And I'll touch on it in supplements as well. But the types of protein, so like, CCK in particular responds to protein and fat mostly, and certain elements of proteins, certain amino acids, certain types of fats, certain vitamins, and certain minerals. There's a theory in nutrition that's called, it's called like the protein gap and the nutrient gap, I'm sure. And it's this idea that humans at a base level will pursue food until they get a certain amount of amino acids, a certain blend of fats, and a certain amount of micronutrients, so vitamins and minerals. So that's like we will continue to chase calories until we hit a certain threshold of that. And it's probably based around CCK because that responds to certain amino acids and it responds to certain vitamins and minerals and fats. When we talk about fatty acid therapy, it's not saturated fats. It's omega-3s, it's omega-9s. So it's like fish oil, it's oleic acid from extra virgin oil, it's primrose oil, it's avocado oil. It's these healthy oils that seem to stimulate this. And it's one thing that we tend to do when we diet is we remove fats. Right. So lower, which I didn't put in here, lower carbohydrate diets tend to work a little bit better. Okay. Olive oil was the word I'm looking for. Let's say, Greg. So that tends to be the best diet. And we're going to get on to supplements in a sec. But what about exercise? Messy when you look at the research, what actually tends to be the most beneficial. But aerobic seems to be a little bit better in the short term for controlling appetite more so than resistance training is. Not that resistance training is a bad thing. Longer term, it allows us to grow muscle. So somewhere for us to dump the carbohydrates that we consume. So it is basically a place that we can store excess carbohydrates. Extremely, extremely effective at that, right? But as we always speak about at MI, it's like for people who can't control appetite when they come in, for people who have blood sugar dysregulation or any of these things, front loading aerobic work and then looking to add in resistance training afterwards seems to be the best approach. Now, some of the supplements here are really, really effective at controlling your appetite, guys. So definitely something to take into consideration if you're going through a plan of dieting and you're struggling to stick to it. Fatty acid therapy, combinations of fatty acids are shown to be really, really effective. And you can see as you go through, just briefly glance your eye through that. When you look at omega-3 just by itself, they didn't do any tests on them all together. So EPA and DHA lowers leptin levels in those where it is chronically elevated, affects insulin resistance, increases GLP-1, and is the most potent fat for stimulating CCK. So it does all these good things all in combination. So getting the right fats in your diet can be super beneficial for you guys to control appetite. And this is the amino acid I'm talking about. We all know glutamine for many different things. We look at glutamine when it comes to digestive health. We look at glutamine in terms of performance. People take it before they train because it can go into what's called like the citric acid cycle and produce energy and do all these really cool things. But most importantly, it affects appetite. So CCK, that hormone that makes us feel full, responds extremely potently to glutamine. And if you look at some of the studies where all they did was when people got extremely hungry, gave them a teaspoon of glutamine in water, tastes gross glutamine. You can get nicer flavors now, I'm sure. And it affected especially sugar cravings. So when you have really bad cravings for sugar, glutamine can be a really effective way at staving those off and pushing them further down the line. It is like this is one of the things, if you ever did listen to Huberman's podcast on this, he goes on about glutamine for a long time and its effects. The mineral that tends to respond to it is magnesium. So in a lot of the studies, they gave people magnesium at different parts throughout the day, sent them out into the world to let them eat ad libitum, so whenever they wanted, so it was under no control, and they just naturally lowered their caloric intake. Like, that's huge. When you send people out freely into the world to eat, we're savages, right? Most people just eat what they want, when they want, when they feel like it. This just naturally lowered it. It affects CCK in the same way. So it's that like vitamin and mineral gap, that protein gap that we're dealing with. It lowers cortisol, affects insulin resistance, increases energy production. It does all the things that we are looking for if we're trying to not feel the effects of hunger. Magnesium is a big one, and it is the most depleted of the minerals. It is basically not in our soil anymore. So a lot of the time we need to supplement it. At the very end, I'll give you a full protocol on this, guys, so you can just take it away. Fiber pops up over and over again. Soluble and insoluble fibers. So you get those wherever you want. You can get it from vegetables, wherever you find the best way, or you can supplement with fiber. They use supplemental fiber with in studies, and what they did was they gave them like 5 to 10 grams of soluble and insoluble fiber before they ate, and they dramatically ate less in those, and people dramatically ate less in those meals. Also, the byproducts of the fermentation of fiber that we find. So when fiber finally gets down into our large intestine, all our little bacteria ferment it. And it produces these things called short chain fatty acids. And they get outside the gut and they travel everywhere. And they're extremely anti-inflammatory. One of the things I didn't touch on in this, because it's just a bit of a broad term, but when we've got inflammation in the brain, inflammation in the liver, inflammation in the cardiovascular system, any of these things, they actually affect the hypothalamus, that central part of the brain that regulates how we feel and how much hunger we feel. And short chain fatty acids have been shown to lower and dampen that inflammation and resensitizing the brain to these hormones. So fiber is a huge one. It's massively underestimated. But the one thing you all have to take into consideration, if you ever decide to supplement with different types of fiber, if you throw 5 to 10 grams of soluble and insoluble fiber into a system that isn't used to it, you're going to know all about it. I always say, I think I've used the phrase here before. I think it was Ben House, who's a functional medicine guy he's from Costa Rica. And he used to say the same thing. Dramatically change the diet and one thing will happen. So it's like massively increase fats, you'll shit your pants. Massively increase fiber, you'll shit your pants. Doing anything to extremes generally leads down that way. So when you're using fiber, slowly does it. But adding fiber into your diet in these circumstances in supplemental form can be super beneficial. This is the most potent one of all by a mile. So berberine is an alkaloid that has been shown to regulate blood sugar so well, it's almost comparable to metformin. Okay, metformin is the drug that's given to type 2 diabetes to control their blood sugar. And it seems to affect leptin resistance. It affects insulin resistance. It lowers lipids. We didn't touch on triglycerides here, but when people have elevated triglycerides, like in metabolic dysfunction, that also blocks all these signals as well. And this has been shown to affect that really, really well. And it's also been shown to increase GLP-1 in a lot of studies. Berberine is really potent at controlling appetite. The biggest problem that you'll find with berberine is it can drop blood sugar quite a lot in certain populations. I don't see it that often. Now, on Huberman's podcast, he spoke about how he got really bad headaches from it. In my experience, that's a whole different mechanism. It's also extremely antimicrobial in the gut, so it kills off bad bacteria, and people get bad side effects with that sometimes. So they'll feel sick, they'll get headaches, they'll feel a little bit fluey, they might get diarrhea. So that is the mechanism I think he was referring to. It's not that it naturally gives headaches, it's just if it's killing off bad bacteria in the gut, which could be a really good thing, right? Now, how would you put all this together in a plan? Right. So what steps can you use, or the people around you that you know might be dying? I know we all have partners, we all have friends, we all have might have kids where they may want to diet in order to lose weight. How would you put all this together? I would go like this. So like diet, whole food, low carb, high protein, high fiber with fatty acid therapy. Damn it, Greg. Therapy. Daily sunlight without sunglasses or some sort of ultraviolet light exposure. I'd use circadian rhythms, so I'd eat at the same time of the day, or if you're trying to move your meal timing, own move it by an hour at a time. Regular and quality sleep. I didn't touch on sleep when I spoke about circadian rhythms. If you take healthy people and you remove 2 hours of their sleep, leptin will drop, so they'll feel hungrier and ghrelin will go up. That's in healthy people guaranteed, and they'll overconsume calories for that day on average by 300 to 400 calories, right? All from hyperpalatable foods. When we allow these hormones to go skew, we do not pursue chicken and vegetables. We pursue hyperpalatable foods. It's just the natural way that humans are, things that are high in calories, because at a base level, we were put on this earth to obtain calories and reproduce. And it's as simple as that at a very base level. So when we become really hungry, we don't pursue stuff for the sh stuff for long-term success. We pursue things limbically and hedonically to satisfy us now, right? That's an important thing to remember. So when we allow these things to go askew, it's really hard to stick to plans. But also in metabolically unhealthy people, when they took away sleep, it made leptin resistance worse, it made insulin resistance worse, and it increased cortisol. So it did the trifecta of bad things. So sleep is huge here. Now, if your sleep is a problem because you don't prioritize it, just so I can prioritize it, like it's important. If it's an issue that you can't figure out, that you have bad sleep, then your coach can help you with that, come up with modalities in order to improve it over time. Increase low impact aerobic work. Greg, I'm gonna volumes is key. Volume is key. We'll let that slide. But you put all these things into your plan and you'll find things an awful lot easier. And then combine it with those things. And you'll have really, really, I'll say, like, you'll have a way better or a way more efficient time as you're trying to lose weight. I hope that helps any of you guys, or if you're going to ever diet again, as we all go through phases of. Has anybody, so I realize I've been vegan for ages. Has anybody got any questions for me in regards to any of that?
Craig, how does that all kind of come together when you have somebody who trains rigorously hard?
In what way? Sorry.
Like if they're trying to undergo like a really, regimented eating program that's getting them to lose weight, but the client also just beats the crap out of himself in the gym. What kind of things might you change?
I guess I would probably look at it in terms of like total volume of training mostly. And it's not necessarily that that's a bad thing. I mean, high training volume can induce more, technically more fat loss. And that could be the reason why they're trying to push that side of the equation. But I think understanding as people become leaner and leaner, actually the less volume generally that they need. Because they're not able to adapt to it anymore. So the adaptation becomes harder when they have less fuel available. So I would normally look to lower volume in those circumstances of people, but allow them to work extremely hard in the sets that they're working, but just lower total training volume is probably where I'd look at that.
And
Is that
would
what
you
you meant?
notice, yeah, and would you notice that like you'd have to manage hunger more or less, or would like cortisol be something to consider? Like just anything like that that might be like a more applicational based knowledge so that people who are listening might like almost identify what they're feeling.
So, in that kind of circumstance, you will have to manage hunger more because the body will seek out more fuel in order to repair the muscles that are damaged. So, I think there would have to be expectations there in terms of how much work you can actually do while aggressively dieting. So, if you look at some of the supplementation, like that's where some of that becomes a little bit more important. So when people become extremely hungry, like a teaspoon of glutamine has been shown to be really, really effective at staving off hunger in those circumstances. With cortisol, cortisol can be a problem. If you're dieting aggressively, that increases cortisol. If you're training aggressively, that will increase cortisol. So all that in combination, as you probably know, when you've got someone who is hyper stressed, which extreme dieting just induces, and then you put the stress of loads of volume and intensity on top of that, it just compounds the problem. Inevitably, not all, like not initially, but inevitably. So it depends on time of dieting, the intensity of that dieting, and then the intensity of the training all in combination to be thought of.
Greg, bit of a random one for you. Well, kind of. Thanks for that, by the way. It was awesome. Really, really useful for me. With the UV light through the eyes, what's the balance of wearing sunglasses or not wearing them at all? Or particularly, we're going into summer down here in Australia, and it's you go outside and sometimes it's blinding, and I try and keep the sunglasses off as much as possible. But is it like a short burst and then they're okay? Or like, what's that balance?
It tends to be about, so not, I'm not basing this on that hormone, by the way, because I don't actually know the direct answer to your question in regards to melanocyte stimulating hormone. But normally you want to talk about like direct sun exposure for like 15 to 20 minutes of the day. And that doesn't mean staring directly at sunlight. It can just be in the sunshine seems to have the most effect for it. So I would say, yeah, like, I mean, there's very much a law of diminishing returns there, but somewhere between 15 and 20 minutes of direct sunlight tends to have the most benefit.
Awesome. Thanks, man.
No problem. You can type in questions if you want.
Hey, Greg. So now I know we're talking about dieting, but I'm thinking from a bulk side. So one reason we would quit a bulk ride is if we start to see symptoms of insulin insensitivity, correct? So would you recommend maybe supplementing berberine to keep your blood sugar lower and extend that period out over a longer time?
It's a really good question. So I've not used it with people on a bulk myself. I don't see why it's a problem. Now, normally, I'm just thinking from my own experience, when people are bulking, it's normally a stage where insulin resistance, yes, that's associated around something that what's called like the P ratio. So normally people hit a threshold of body fat where when they start, so like if I'm just going to make up an arbitrary number, right? So say you, for example, you eventually get to 18% body fat on your bulk. You hit a certain threshold where above that, you'll notice that most of it accumulates in fatty tissue now. It doesn't accumulate in muscle like it was before. And that's called P ratio. So it gets to a stage in a diet where the substrates you use don't go towards muscle anymore. They tend to go to more towards fat. You could use berberine. Berberine, though, long term has been shown to, like metformin, weaken muscle. So you could use it sporadically, but it's normally the fat accumulation that will affect a bulk before something like insulin resistance does. Now, it would be an interesting thought experiment or an N equals one experiment to see if it does allow you to stay in the bulk for longer, but I'm not 100% sure. I've heard of people doing it, but I've never used it myself. It seems kind of counterintuitive because when they give people berberine with like eucaloric, so the same amount of calories to maintain their weight, they tend to lose weight. So it just seems a little bit counterintuitive, but worth a try. I hope that kind of helps.
Oh, yeah. Thank you.
Oh, one other thing
Great.
is, oh, sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to throw in a quick question. I joined late. I was picking up children, but I joined in right when you were talking about the melanocytes. Did you discuss anything about the melanotan, like the injectable? Did you go into that or no? Is that
I
not something we
mentioned
want to approach here?
no. So I mentioned that now, like there's a peptide that they're using now, which is similar, right? And I said I didn't actually. So all I know about it is that it makes you tanned and horny, right? I didn't know anything else about it. If you have
I
more
heard
information,
that.
I'd be interested to hear it.
Okay. Thank you. I appreciate it, man.
So like I said, it makes you so it increases tan, it increases libido, and it massively suppresses appetite. So it's why it's being used in the sphere now as well. Also, like in terms of like the importance when we talk about supplementation, it's the importance of the quality of them as well. Because I know like we've got a lot of links, and like the one that I used even before I started working with MI, the ones that I could get in the UK. Like if even if you're looking at like fatty acid therapy, Designs for Health does a brilliant one where it's got the combination of 3, 6, and 9, which can be hard to find a decent combination of that. And like so we've got all the links to Designs for Health, ATP Labs, and Thorne now. So if any of the supplements that you're looking for on this chat, you can definitely go through them. We have links. Anybody else?
Great. I had one just kind of unrelated. I was waiting for someone else to have something more related, but a client of mine is using, well, semi-client. I'll call this person an acquaintance. is using whatchamacallit,
Yes.
Ozempic, yeah. Okay, can that change? And I know what your bodily fluid type, smell changes can happen with keto and any sort of diet, really, when you're changing that kind of chemistry. But how are you familiar with anything extreme as far as smell changes, bodily smell changes with that specific product?
So, just for clarity, right? So, Ozempic is remember, like I mentioned a few times in that chat about GLP-1. It's an incretin that makes well, it's responsible for the first phase of insulin release, blah blah blah. But it makes us feel full. That's what Ozempic is playing on now. So it's a GLP-1 agonist, so it increases more of it. Now, I've never heard anything in terms of sense of smell. But one thing that's come out and research that I saw literally, which is quite handy you asked, just this morning, Ozempic is starting to show to cause real disruption within the gut microbiome. So I know we thought about like it as a magic drug, and it is, it works really effectively in fairness for the majority of people, but there does seem to be appearing some side effects with it that are very undesirable. But in terms of smell, in terms of what they smell, or how they smell or what they smell.
No, it's not their ability to smell or their sense of smell. It's more of like bodily fluid, like their sweat smells different and other things smell different.
That's interesting. No, I haven't heard anything about that yet.
Okay, I told him I'd ask, so
Yeah,
thank you.
I'll have a look actually. That's interesting. Anybody else before we wrap up then? We good, gents? All right, guys. It's my bedtime. Finished 8 minutes early. Thank you all. And if any questions do pop up, I'm on the Telegram group. You can either message me individually or put a question up in the group. I really appreciate you all and enjoy the rest of your evening. Bye, guys.